Hi, this is John Udell. My guest this week is John Wilkin. He's with the University of Michigan Library, where he directs the technology department and coordinates the library's joint digitization project with Google. It's been 2 years since Google began partnering with the University of Michigan and other libraries, including Harvard and the New York Public Library. In this conversation, we talk about the University of Michigan's earlier and still ongoing efforts to digitize its 7 million volume library, about how the partnership with Google has radically accelerated that process, and about what this is all going to mean for libraries, for publishers, for Google, and for all of us.
This is John Wilkin. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thanks for calling. Maybe we could start by reviewing the prehistory of all of this, which was your efforts at the University of Michigan on your own to digitize the contents of the library, and that, I guess, sputtered along for a while.
Yeah.
But was, nonetheless, a real initiative. What were the issues there?
It's absolutely fair to characterize it as sputtered along. When we first started doing it, there were a couple of things that were prominent in what we were doing. One of them was what was then university library effort to kick off JSTOR. And I think probably you and your listeners will know JSTOR as the big journal conversion and archiving effort.
Mm-hmm.
We proposed it along with some other campus leadership, and a lot of the early efforts were housed here in the library and leveraged library resources.
And we're talking roughly when for this stuff?
95, mm-hmm. 96.
Okay, that's what I thought.
There's a book on the history of JSTOR, but I think our earliest thing, these roots, were back in that kind of 94 to 95 period.
Okay.
I believe in 94 we had the beginnings of the effort here as a pilot.
Okay. So what became apparent from what you told me last time is that it just wasn't going to scale.
Yeah, the other thing that I think is germane here is not JSTOR, but another Mellon-funded thing that was I think more properly 95 rather than 94, and that was the first Making of America grant that we had with Cornell.
Yes.
There we did a few thousand volumes, and on the tail end of that brought together the leadership of a key group of libraries that was probably either the germs of, or in fact was at that time, the beginnings of the Digital Library Federation.
Okay.
To talk about using that as the beginnings of something broader and more collaborative for doing this retrospective conversion, the conversion of print.
So these were some of or many of the ones involved in the current efforts?
Yeah, right, yeah. And probably about 20 institutions, I think,
okay.
And all the major players in digital library efforts.
I'll include a link to the Making of America project, but in case people haven't seen it.
Yep, it's an easy one for me to do. MOA, which stands for Making of America,
mm-hmm.
UMDL, it stands for University of Michigan Digital Library, UMich, UMich.edu.
Mm-hmm.
So MOA. UMDL.UMich.edu.
Mm-hmm.
And we did try very hard at that point to bring these other institutions into something that would be more comprehensive. And part of the logic that we used, and we talked about at the time, was how something that even on a small scale of, say, 5,000 volumes a year, spread over a dozen or two dozen or more large research libraries, actually begins to amount to something
mm-hmm.
over a multi-year period over many libraries.
Mm-hmm.
But there were no takers, absolutely none, in that, and a great deal of skepticism about whether it would even be possible to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we returned to that a number of times over the years. In 97, we returned to Mellon for more support on the Making of America and did about 9,000 volumes at that point, which was, I think, then our largest effort of the sort,
mm-hmm.
and provided to them the results, which was a cost study that they could use in evaluating the beginnings of an onslaught of proposals they were getting for digitization of materials.
Okay.
But all very much uncoordinated. So it wasn't happening, and I think that this is one of the things that comes into the discussions a lot. We would have preferred that libraries come together around this. I think there is good reason to hope that that sort of thing would be possible or should be possible, but it wasn't happening.
And right.
So we did roughly 5,000 volumes a year for a long period of time, as many as 9,000 in that big year with Making of America, but that was what we were doing.
And so to place this into some context, what is the target? In other words, what's the number of volumes in your library, and what's the total non-duplicated number across the partner libraries?
is one of those questions that nobody's able to answer, but we make a wild stab.
Yeah.
We know that we own somewhat more than 7 million volumes here at the University of Michigan, 7 million in the university library, and that doesn't include our significant law library and business administration library.
Hmm.
The estimates about number of unique volumes across all institutions is drawn from some analysis in the OCLC, the online computer library catalog, and there we're talking about a small number of tens of millions of volumes.
Okay, and so at some point, Google gets involved, and we'll talk through the early history of that, but just to whet people's appetite, you're doing, I think you told me, 1 million volumes a year in your basement right now, is that or wherever the undisclosed location may be.
And it's not in our basement anymore, though. It never was, to be frank.
Yeah.
It was in part of the library's facilities on campus,
right.
But it has since moved off into Google facilities.
Okay.
And, right, 1 million volumes a year is plus or minus earlier, and definitely plus now and later, that we've ramped up to that kind of volume.
And so at this point, I wouldn't want to say the end's in sight, but in fact, it kind of is, right?
Right. It's a measurable end at this point.
Yeah.
So we've talked about 6 years, and there were the early days of ramp up in the project, and I think that we probably reasonably have 5 more years of work to do.
So from a purely engineering perspective, review for me just the mechanics of being able to do this non-destructively and at an incredibly high rate.
We do both destructive and non-destructive scanning. A lot of our early work was destructive, and as you move into a lot of the collection, it's not possible to do that. In some cases, it's necessary to do that. We do a fair amount now with non-destructive, and with the technology that we use, not what Google uses, what we use, it's a camera-like operation. There are devices like the Zoitol that we use and a number of other commercial products that are unextraordinary that take a cradle that accommodates a volume that needs to have some care in handling a spine that may not be entirely intact or where the pages are brittle. And this camera, this planetary camera, does a top-down shot of the pages and does any rectification necessary to produce a nice square square image of the page.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do now. And I think that pretty much anything that works in this kind of space does things that are like that. And I think you and the listeners have seen some of the demonstrations of this kind of technology. The robotic scanner at Stanford, for example, from the Swiss company, is another key example of that.
So there's a distinction here as between destructive and non-destructive scanning, and there's a distinction between what it is that the University of Michigan is doing on its own and what it is that Google is doing, and is there a connection between those two things? I guess I'm now a little unclear on who does what and where the massive speed up is coming from.
Let me go back to this what we're doing and what they're doing kind of thing.
Okay.
The bulk of the work that's being done here, the overwhelming majority is being done by Google, but some materials don't fit into the project for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so we continue doing the kind of work that we've been doing in the past. And I wanted to give the example of the Zoitol, for example, as a type of technology that can be used for this kind of non-destructive scanning.
Okay. Why are the things that you do that aren't appropriate for the joint project inappropriate?
It may be that they are in a special collection that we haven't yet provided access to for Google.
Okay.
But it also may be that they are so damaged, in such poor repair, that Google isn't able to handle those materials. And that's typically the case.
Okay, gotcha. So it's a curatorial kind of thing, a preservation thing.
You should know that until 1990, acid-free paper was not widely used in printing. And so materials before 1990 are, by and large, in a state of decay.
Right.
And before the 1950s, that was prevalent, and it has been long enough that you have fairly serious embrittlement for a lot of those materials.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to the turn of the century, for example,
mm-hmm.
and you look at materials like the early English Text Society editions, which were heavily used and printed on brittle paper,
mm-hmm.
they are breaking across the text block. Large groups of pages are breaking simply by the fact of somebody opening that book.
Right.
And that kind of decay is very difficult to stop. And once started, it's impossible to reverse. So we do some destructive scanning by removing the spine from those materials and carefully scanning these loose pages.
Okay.
And from those, we're able to create nice high-resolution facsimiles of the original.
So in the what you say is the overwhelming majority of the work that is being done by Google and at Google's facility, there's still a split as between destructive and non-destructive? And what's your sense of the relative weights of those two?
For Google, everything is non-destructive.
Everything is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And yet, there's a tremendous acceleration of the rate at which this work is progressing.
That's right.
Due to...
I wish I could explain more, and I think that that's probably where we need to let the listeners' imagination work. It's something that they have achieved a tremendous throughput with.
Okay, and that's really the point. I'm not asking for details here. I'm just trying to make the point that this is an invention.
That's right.
By them for this purpose and is working. Basically, this is the point, right?
We're still lucky if we do 5,000 volumes a year, and you only need to do the math to see how many they're doing a day. And
yes.
Those numbers are comparable. They're probably doing 5,000 a day. So
yeah.
That's what we work toward for a year.
Okay. So the resolution at which the stuff is being stored is extremely high, as I understand it. And without going into details that you can't go into, there's a sort of a principle here, which I think I'd like to try to bring out about what is necessary for online use and what is available for other uses, including the reconstruction of print volumes.
Yeah. I want to jump ahead, if you don't mind,
sure.
to one of the questions you raised, the contractual arrangements. And I want to refer people to a website at here at the University of Michigan where we have our contract online, and
okay.
I'm going to refer to a few clauses
okay.
in part to build some underpinnings for your question.
Good.
The website is www.liblib.umich.edu/mdp. I'll do that again, www.liblib.umich.edu/mdp. And MDP stands for Michigan Digitization Project, what
okay.
we called the project when we started it a few years ago.
Okay.
At that site, there is a link to our agreement with Google. There were three principles that we hammered out, starting in the discussions with Larry Page, where we talked about ensuring quality consistent with our preservation scanning.
Mm-hmm.
And the clause that's relevant here is 2.4, where we refer to the benchmarking that gets done to produce high-quality images.
Mm-hmm.
Handling materials, particularly this non-destructive work, and that's in clause 2.7.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last part, which I think we'll return to later, is our rights in the materials, which is section 4.4, 4.1
okay.
and 4.4.1 and 4.4.2. I'll come back to that last one later. We'll have some opportunities to talk about that. But in the first case, this preservation surrogate kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
what happens is that this very, very large, very high-resolution image is captured, and derivatives are created for use. And because displays, monitors don't typically have the kind of resolution that paper does, there's a down-rendering process to create for users on Google Book Search to create an image that fits the space.
Yes.
That's usable. We get a 600 dpi or ppi image here at Michigan as our master. We get a copy of all the images that Google produces, and we get a 600 dpi resolution bitonal master for all the pages that are black print on white paper.
Okay.
And it's this process of extracting the images from the bigger high-resolution image that I think people need to know about. They have this nice use version that they can enjoy on Google Book Search and even on our website where we're down-rendering for use. It's something that's more like 100 ppi for the display. but there's more data there.
And a point here is that these, what you call down renderings, can be, and in fact are being done independently by different organizations, including Google, including your library, potentially, including other partners, right? Everyone,
that's right.
Everyone can,
yeah.
And maybe has their own take on how they want to render from the master.
That's a good point. I mean, that is exactly right. And I can only speak for us, but we do that rendering on the fly. Mm-hmm. We use open source tools, mm-hmm. and we try to get it right for screen reading.
Mm-hmm. And in what context will someone encounter the version that you've rendered on the fly as against the version that Google is making available generally? Like where do you have to be to see these things?
In our online catalog here at Michigan, the catalog is Merlyn, mm-hmm. MIRLYN. Mm-hmm. There are an increasing number of links to the materials. As they flow back to us, the links appear automatically.
Okay.
We've automated this process of incorporating the content. And for all those things that we have rights, where it's either public domain or where some circumstances have given us the right, maybe a negotiation with a rights holder, mm-hmm. we show the content to the user, and that is made possible through a link in the catalog. So it's kind of nice if you're a user of Merlyn, particularly if you're at the University of Michigan on campus and you're using the catalog to find things more serendipitously. Now you will find that the digital copy is available to you, and you may not have to go to the library to use it.
So just curious here, since I happen to be a University of Michigan alumnus, what is the deal for alumni in terms of lifelong access, if you will, to these kinds of resources as now being made available by the university?
We've for some time seen our role in these efforts about being a better library and a very, very broad, unconstrained sense of the term, better services to users around content, better engagement with scholars, particularly our scholars, better access to content, mm-hmm. better long-term curation of that content. And often that is something that we can certainly try to do without regard to affiliation.
Yeah.
So all the public domain materials in our collection are accessible whether you're a U of M user or not.
Okay.
Available to everybody in the world. And we think there's a small, marginal cost to our extending that kind of access. And incidentally, just to be clear, we see that as a very significant part of our curation of the archive as our role in a library. We're not seeing this as a replacement or competition for Google Book Search,
yes.
but we do have this commitment to these copies for perpetuity, as long as the University of Michigan and its library are around.
Okay.
We'll do that. We all feel that Google Book Search is going to be the preferred medium for our users as well as the rest of the world. But again, it's that commitment to in perpetuity.
Sure.
For Google, it's going to happen as long as it makes sense as a business.
Sure.
And we can ensure that we're going to have this kind of commitment to the content for the longer haul. There are also other sorts of services that we can provide, and they may be, in these cases, tied to affiliation, Section 108 and copyright law for those materials that are so badly damaged or embrittled and are not in print. DMCA provisions allow us to provide in-library access mm-hmm. to that limited subset of materials.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that would happen for somebody who is on-site, whether they're a U of M user or not. And there may be cases where we are able to negotiate more access to content for people who are current faculty, staff, and students.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened yet, but we've had some nice conversations with rights holders and their representatives.
Since you mentioned the contract, and we were going to return to some clauses of that, there obviously has been a certain amount of public debate and public skepticism about the way in which Google has, according to some people, been negotiating separately with the different participating libraries and coming up with, you know, slightly different arrangements with each of them. And one upshot of that being that it's not obvious how the partner libraries would or could collaborate amongst themselves.
Ultimately, I can only speak about the contracts that I can see, and since you and I talked, I think the California contract had just come out.
Yes.
Is that right, John?
Yes, it has.
And since then, the Wisconsin contract has come out. So we have some information there that we can make determinations about what sorts of opportunities there are there.
Mm-hmm.
The Wisconsin contract is very interesting in that they've been given permission to contribute their content to a repository, storage, archiving effort with another partner. And since we're another partner and close collaborator with Wisconsin, that's the kind of thing that makes some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could use this as a segue to talk about that clause in our contract about a federation of institutions, the 4.4.2. We believe from the outset that it's important to see this not as our collection in isolation or as a library effort in isolation, competing with other library efforts, but using this as the springboard for a larger collaborative library effort, and have been talking to a number of institutions for several years at this point about trying to leverage our resource, our copy, in something that would serve a broader community and in which a broader community could invest. And those discussions have been going on in the CIC, the Big Ten and the University of Chicago, for the last year and a half or more.
Can you just spell out CIC for people?
Yeah, it's the Committee on Institutional Cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
Wisconsin is one of the CIC institutions, and so there is, I think, a growing chance that there will be something that does represent a community-based archiving effort where we can begin to look at creating a comprehensive collection, where we can start building that out, filling in the gaps.
Presumably, as time goes on, more of these contracts, maybe all of them, will have come to light, and then it'll be a little clearer what's even going to be possible.
The Digital Library Federation is about 30 institutions, and the Google partners are all, nearly all members of the Digital Library Federation. I guess it's important to say that this cooperation doesn't begin and end with the Google partners, that there is an important space for libraries to collaborate. Mm-hmm. Another one of our organizations is the Association of Research Libraries, large research libraries that invest in these kinds of collections.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's there and abroad that we need to focus on how we can build something that serves interests broadly.
So we've talked a whole lot here about logistics of getting these books scanned and how these institutions are related to one another contractually, but said little about what does this add up to, the big vision. Most of us are only starting to get some glimpses of what this is going to mean. And for me, one of those moments was a blog item that Tim O'Reilly posted where, just in passing, he had occasion to look up the source of a quote, and he found exactly where it came from. And that was just one of those transformative moments that it just, to have put in the text and come back with the citation in that way was something that was not previously possible. And from my perspective, I did a more detailed search and was fascinated to see that just instantly I could find 15 or 20 different places where that quotation had been used, sometimes with attribution and sometimes without, which is one issue. But the other interesting issue was how you could see the sources that used this quotation divide into different categories and begin to do, I don't even know what the word for this kind of analysis is, but I would call it meme flow analysis or something like that. That sort of instantly you could kind of see how this meme had propagated through sort of different avenues of cultural discourse. That's just an example, right? It's just, to me, sort of like a tip of the iceberg example of, even just from a search perspective, and never mind the issues around full views and copyright and all of that, right? That just that kind of pervasive search of the corpus of books. Share what kinds of things you've seen in terms of people realizing what they can do with this and what it will mean.
I like your example, John. It's really, I think, one of the things that is important here is as we open up the body of material to larger and larger groups of people, that there is this kind of fruitful interplay of minds and activities that wasn't possible before. I think that a lot of the examples are that we've had the seeds of for some time. Soon after we brought that first body of Making of America materials online,
mm-hmm.
we were contacted by the chair of a history department at a major University of California institution who said that he had just had to recall his book from the publisher because of the kind of material that he was finding, the things that he was finding that he hadn't found before
yeah.
in doing his research as he completed the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that kind of the data we would not have otherwise found. But your example of different ways of making meaning, for example, that we can see in the larger body of materials is one that there will be more examples of that as more content is out there and as more people turn their attention to it.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we need to avoid, and I think that this is still an issue, is that some people would like to see these things as finite and bounded commodities, but what we see when we create this large space for collaboration is that kind of fruitful interplay that
mm-hmm.
does things that we knew were possible before, but to an extent that we never would have imagined, and it takes off with this community of minds working
yeah.
around things.
Those of us who hang around in the blogosphere have been spoiled and have the luxury of kind of taking that mode for granted. But
right.
it sort of makes you step back and realize the extent to which, first of all, most people don't take that for granted, and second of all, even if they did, it would only be available in the context of the really very small sliver of stuff which is currently existing on the web and is not at all connected to the vast legacy.
Right. I want to give you an example of the sort of thing that happens. There are areas of scholarship that are based on scarcity of access to a type of resource.
Yeah.
So the Dead Sea Scrolls or papyrus and other sorts of rare materials. You still hear from very progressive people, very young scholars, that one of the things that is important about this body of materials is that it be locked away for a select group of people to have some advantage with. And I think that what we see in the blogosphere and other sorts of things that are happening out there in the world is the way that we all benefit, and the bright minds are made brighter by what happens through this kind of broad collaboration. Don't lock it up. Open it up as much as possible. We've got copyright to deal with in this space, and that is one constraint.
Mm-hmm.
But even with the kinds of restrictions that we have, either in Google Book Search or in our own catalog where we give you a list of all the pages that have the result, people have some notion of the relevance of the work and whether something in fact exists.
Yes. I wanted to also ask you about this book reconstruction.
Yeah.
So I'm here in my office, and I have a copy of this book that you gave me when I visited you in October. And the title page reads, A Discourse Delivered by Henry Tappan at Ann Arbor, Michigan on the occasion of his inauguration as Chancellor, December 21st, 1852. And this is a bound volume, which you told me was reconstructed from the high-res scans and is available for sale on Amazon. Now, I still haven't found it there, so maybe you can help me with that. But to kind of walk through the backstory there of...
I'm almost absolutely certain that that volume is not available on Amazon because there are some constraints right now that we're up against. One of them is size. If it's too small, it won't be available for at least a while.
Okay.
And that volume that you have, it was the inaugural address at the First University of Michigan and is more a pamphlet than it is a work, and you can see that in the quality of the original printing. But there are, at this point, from the things that we have digitized in our collection and where we have unconstrained rights, and we know that there is some interest, about 12,000 titles. So if you go in and you do a search on the phrase Michigan Historical Reprint Series, you will get something on the order of 12,000 to 13,000 titles, and that will grow. And those are Making of America titles, historical mathematical works, for example. And the quality is even better than what you have in your hand, or is much better, I should say, mm-hmm. than what you have in your hand, because because the original pages often were of a better quality than that pamphlet printing. So we've done digitization for reprint services for university presses, for example, where it was impossible to tell the difference in the university press had to look for the archive stamp in the book to make sure that they had the right one.
Okay.
And we're doing new printing, too, from primarily digital projects, though that's not in the Michigan Historical Reprint Series, but we tend to do a lot of digital publishing here at the university in the library, and we have, in many cases, made those things available in print.
In terms of the historical stuff, in effect, you are bringing back to life as physical books, which people can buy, things that have not been that way for a very long time.
That's right.
I can imagine why, but why don't you say why you're doing that and what the deal is here? You're not trying to become a bookseller for profit,
nope.
Right? You're just trying to fulfill a mission here, and this is a way to do that.
It's about that long tail, really. I think that one of the things that the technology makes possible is it's again one of those marginal cost arguments. We've covered the base cost in the digitization, and that was the end, was getting those things digitized so that we could protect the original or replace the original in some cases and make them available to our users. That's a cost that is a sunk cost. But beyond that, there is relatively little cost in bringing the item back into print.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there is demand across that long tail. And so there have been cases, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, but the Civil War era poet Bob Dylan uses in Modern Times. We had digitized both of his volumes in an earlier effort, and so they're available on Amazon and are being purchased today. There are works that are specific to specific regions and states, and we've had interest from people in those areas or legislators that wanted to buy multiple copies for a constituency.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that kind of small interest. I'll just add one more example. Mathematical materials never go out of style. Once you've proved something, it continues to be relevant. So this large collection, I think of 1,000 volumes in non-Euclidean geometry that's in there, those things may be used in current research as well, and it may be that the print is easier to work with than the digital, but in all cases, I think the costs are relatively low, about $25. Tends to vary depending on size, but for something that's a nice quality, acid-free, paper-bound copy.
It's just so incredibly cool. Now, in some cases, this would be a situation where you might have the rights to do it, but perhaps Google might not. In other cases, both might have the right to do it. I mean, it would just depend.
We haven't really embarked on evaluating that question in the digitization of our materials. Both we and Google have had some interest there. There is some cost in bringing something back into print.
Sure.
And if we brought everything back into print, we would lose money. So having some way to do it selectively or leveraging Google's great resources in being able to do it, one of those things is going to make the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we just haven't gotten to that, answering that question with Google.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are going to see these Google materials back in print, and it may be through us or through Google, but I think in the end it won't matter to them. They'll find them in Amazon and through other booksellers and be able to get copies inexpensively.
And just for the benefit of people who may be listening and, you know, obviously can't see the thing I'm holding in my hand or the better thing that you may be holding in your hand in your office, the book that you showed me was, you know, not only to my untrained eye, completely indistinguishable from, you know, sort of an original publication, right? In other words, there was no way I could tell just looking at it that it had been through this process of digitization and reconstruction. But you told me that even people who have trained eyes are hard put to tell the difference.
That's right. When we have a good source, when we have a particularly good source, we can create a good replica, and telling the differences is extraordinarily hard and usually may involve being able to draw on something more than artifactual information, you know, being able to look at a number or a stamp or something like that in the book. But thank you for that. It's great to hear that we're doing a good job and we do a good job.
I mean, maybe it's just me, but it seems like an aspect of this project that hasn't been widely recognized. I was just floored when you told me that and when you showed me that. And I just, you know, there's been a lot of chatter about this project, but that just, at least from my perspective, is a piece of the story that hadn't kind of come out. So the way that it plays into, as you said, the long tail scenario is wonderful, I think. I mean, it's just a great thing to see. You know, so
I think where we all recognize we need to get next is good ebook versions of these things so that people can take them around on portable devices.
Right, right, right. What do you think about that now that you bring it up? I mean, what are the again, you know, setting aside the sort of rights issues and so on, what are the purely sort of technical constraints, do you think, and assuming you have the right to make an ebook and sell it to someone in terms of making it a useful thing?
You know, I think a lot of this depends on one's perspective and priorities and things. We have a devotion here, a slavish devotion to quality. So we run a text encoding project here where we're working on a significant body of the early printed material in the English language up from the beginning of printing up through up to 1800. And we aim for a level of quality there that, and I give the numbers, 99.995% accurate. People say, oh, there are errors, and we have to point out that the original, and typically our best publishers, have more errors than that. I think that the problem, the challenge, is not in whether or how much, say, these public domain things are locked down, but in what the right way is in getting them to be more usable copies. How do we get the OCR corrected? Is that through the distributed proofreaders program, which is a great thing, incidentally.
I was going to mention that now. So the project that you're describing is under the umbrella of Gutenberg, first of all. Is that right?
They're loosely related to Gutenberg. I think that they have some very staunch independence.
Okay, but for example, you can share with other parts of Project Gutenberg the services of the distributed proofreading. Is that
That's right.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and that for again people who may not have heard about it is a fascinating example. I think not very well known yet of what more broadly we see happening. Let's say through something like Amazon's Mechanical Turk, right, where the harnessing of human capability through the network in ways that apply, if you will, sort of mechanical leverage. So in this case, you'd get four or five people to proofread something and would wind up with an arbitrary level of precision.
Yeah, right. Or maybe not an arbitrary level of precision, but something that's measured and where, you rely on the social component and you add to it something that is managed and technical.
Yeah.
That's one of the extraordinary things about distributed proofreaders is that social component of using the web. So there's that, and I think that good text benefits from some level of encoding to represent structure, for example, chapters, that kind of thing. So there is, beyond the question of how you get a high level of accuracy, how you get the text to be more usable, to be more functional in our readers. I think those probably are things to devote some energy to, but I think we'll see that happen in the next year or so.
It's all really exciting, and it's just one of those wonderful things that I see happening. And, there's sort of an axis to this, which is the one that I think a lot of people have focused on, which has to do with there's a certain amount of commercial competition, and there's a struggle for ownership. Lots of still unresolved, thorny issues about copyright.
Yeah.
And so that's all ongoing, and there are plenty of valid concerns and things to talk about and worry about there. But woven through all of that is... this is an amazingly wonderful thing that's happening.
Yeah. I think if I could just close with one thing, it strikes me from all the things we're talking about that what a lot of times gets focused on is the opposition of interests, and interests get stated as being in opposition to each other, libraries and Google and publishers. But I think that what is really exciting about this is the convergence of interests. and interests and the way that so many of them can be followed or supported or where the benefits are felt in each of those areas. Libraries will benefit in the area of preservation and archiving from this effort. Whatever Google does, Google will create this tremendous service, as they have already begun to do, that makes discovery so much more possible. And publishers, too, I think will benefit in significant ways by increased visibility, increases in sales, and I think in increased attention to different types of reading.
Thank you for that. I didn't really have the ability to pull that together, but I was kind of hoping that you could, and you definitely did. So that's great.
Thank you. John, this is great. And when you're in town again, look me up.
I'd love to.